Good afternoon to everyone. Certainly would like to add to what everyone has already said to thank Willie and Michaela for opening up their home. And it's just wonderful to be here. Glad that we're here today and to be with all of you. And Corey, it was Chef Alfredo's. How could you forget that? Well, I did forget the name of it. Mary Beth actually had to tell me. I'll tell you, that's a place that feeds you like a man. If you're happy to have a salad and a glass of water and you say to yourself, I'm done, that's not the place to go. Because they really feed you there. That's Chef Alfredo's. Great place, great food. You know, I was thinking of an analogy regarding what we have in our hands. And really what the Bible is God's garden. And I really think that's an appropriate analogy. It is a garden that has 66 magnificent trees or books. Each tree in God's garden is full of ripe, succulent fruit. It really doesn't matter where you enter God's garden. You can start in the very beginning with the tree called Genesis, which happens to be the oldest tree in God's garden. Or you could even go right into the middle to the book of Psalms, or the tree of Psalms, if we can carry through with the analogy. That is the largest tree in God's garden. It has 150 branches or chapters. There are also small trees in God's garden because they have few branches, few chapters. But the branches they do have are loaded with fruit. Literally every tree in God's garden is bending because of the weight of the fruit that each branch has. I want to focus on one of the smaller trees in God's garden today, but my focus more specifically on just one branch, one chapter of that tree. It's a tree that is called the Song of Solomon. There has been, unfortunately, and still remains, a lot of negativity around this book, around this tree. This is what the Encyclopedia Britannica says about the Song of Solomon. And I quote, "There is no coherent story in the book," unquote. Another source says this, and I quote, "Some of the rabbis around the time of Christ and after, who were somewhat embarrassed by the plain language of the Song of Solomon, decided it was an allegory. Many of the early Catholic fathers were similarly embarrassed by the plainness of the book. And one thing they were all convinced of was that it certainly didn't mean what it said. And they found this rather embarrassing and didn't see why something like that should be in the Bible." You know what they're saying? That small tree doesn't have any fruit. What's it doing in God's garden? So that's why I want to take a little closer look. But there's a subtext with chapter one. And what I'd like to do is a brief character study of the two main players in chapter one. So if you would turn to Song of Solomon, I want to focus on chapter one. And this is how Solomon begins when he sat down to write it. It's his song. He wrote it. And this is what he says. "The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Because of the fragrance of your good ointments, your name is ointment poured forth. Therefore, the virgins love you. Draw me away. We will run after you. And the king has brought me into his chambers." I mean, is there something missing here? There doesn't seem to be a story. What's the context? Doesn't seem to be a relationship. Is it talking about a crush, a fantasy, a dream? And it is sexually charged. I mean, we've gone from zero to 100 in about 20 seconds. We're in the king's chamber, and the song just started. You can see what's in Solomon's mind. You can see what's most important to him and what's first in his life. It's about the flesh and how much he can get of it. He's married here, but not to her. Chapter 6. In verse 8, we read, there are 60 queens. Now, I think I read that wrong. There are 60 queens. At this stage of his life, it appears that he has 60 wives. 60. And 80 concubines. 80. And virgins without number. And in chapter 1, we have another young lady in his chamber. I don't think she's there to do his taxes. He has something else on his mind. It's another young woman. We don't know her name. We don't see her face. There's no relationship here. His own carnality is out of control at this stage of his life. It's about feeding the lusts of his flesh. And it's all about the get. Let's compare with what we read in 1 Kings. 1 Kings chapter 3. Notice verse 3 of 1 Kings chapter 3. And Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except that he sacrificed and burned incense at the high places. He wasn't perfect. But he appears to be a different man here. What's in his mind? It says he loved God. And to love God is to do what he says. To be concerned about that. To be mindful of that. And in verse 5 we read, at Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, ask, what shall I give you? Did he ask for women? There's something else that's motivating him, something else that's in his mind and in his heart. He says, you have shown, in verse 6, great mercy to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in truth, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart with you. And you've continued this great kindness for him, and you have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. Now, O Lord, my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father, David, but I am a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people, whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart. Why? To get? To somehow take advantage financially or in some other way to the people that he was to be king over? No, not at all. It was to give. To judge your people, he says, that I may discern between good and evil, for who's able to judge this great people of yours? It was to be able to guide, direct, counsel in a proper and right way, serving God's people. But something changed over time, because when we come to the Song of Solomon, his mind is somewhere else. Here at this point, he's off. He's way off, and he's sinning. Notice what he writes in Proverbs 14. He wrote this in Proverbs 14. Proverbs 14. In verse 12, it says, there's a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. He wrote this, and he sees nothing wrong in committing adultery. He's unfaithful, and he is supremely selfish. You know what this young lady is to him? She's just a crayon. You know, I remember one feast, my mom got my brother and I a huge Crayola crayon box. Because previous to that, when we'd get a coloring book, when we were little, we'd get that small crayon box. I think it has 8 crayons in it. It's all the standard colors. But this feast, we got that big box. I think it was 64 crayons in that thing. Has that, oh, that lid on it on the very back. It has that sharpener for your crayon. And I remember there was all these colors. We would just, my brother and I would take a color that we'd never seen before. We'd scribble a little bit. Nah, I don't like it. We put it back in, never to use it again. That's what she was. That's what all the ladies were to him, were just a crayon. I mean, it's simple math. He ended up with 1,000 women in his box. 1,000. 700 wives and 300 concubines. If you divide 1,000 by the 40 years that he reigned, that works out to 25 different women. In other words, 25 different crayons a year to use. About one every other week, if you stick to that simple math. What did he do with them? He took and he got. And he took away from each and every single lady the opportunity to have a happy, fulfilling marriage, because he's already a lousy husband to 80. You think about it this way. What do you say to the one who would become number 81 or 112 or 316 or Mrs. Solomon 427? You get the point. We need to get married. What did he say to these ladies? He had to say something. I love you more than anything. You're the one for me. Will you marry me? He said that to 700 different women. What about the ones who became his concubines? What did he say to them? Well, I really, really, really like you, but I'm getting married next week. So I'm going to put you in a box. It's a special box. And I'll pull you out when I feel like it. And then I'll throw you back in. That's what a concubine was. And he said that to 300 different women. What did he say to the ones he didn't like? We don't know about those, do we? Notice 1 Kings, what this pathway of unfaithfulness led to was manifested in the way he lived. 1 Kings 11. 1 Kings 11 and verse 1, it says, but King Solomon loved many foreign women. Do you think he gave them anything? Had any concern? He was unfaithful to all of them. He loved them in a physical way, to satisfy himself. You know, the human nature is like a black hole. And the more you feed it, the more you have to feed it, because it's insatiable. And he lost control of himself. It says he loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonites, Hittites. And it was obviously not enough. From the nations whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry. Now he's not even following any of the instructions that God had given. Anything goes, everything goes in his mind. There's no fence anywhere. There's no wall for conduct. You shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods. And Solomon clung to these in love. He had 700 wives. 700. Wonder if that came with mother-in-laws. what a disaster he had on his hand when it comes to family relations. You think he had a relationship with anybody? Do you think he really knew the names of 98% of these ladies? 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. Something else was number one now. Not God anymore, because he was unfaithful. For it was so when he was old, his wives turned his heart after other gods. The true God appeared to him twice. And now he's serving gods of stone that have no ears and no eyes, can't talk, can't do a thing, and he's serving them. And his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonites, after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. And Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not fully follow the Lord as did his father David. He crashed his life. Then it says, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab. That's a god that human sacrifices were offered to. What in the world is he thinking? On the hill that is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon. And he did likewise for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. So the Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned from the Lord God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Brethren, he's not loyal. He's serving false gods. He's disobedient. He's carnal. And he's unfaithful. I want to turn our attention to the young lady. You know, all we know about her is where she's from. Chapter 6 and verse 13, she's referred to as a Shulamite. From the town of Shulam, or Shunem, depends on the margin, actually refers to two different spellings for that town. We don't know her name, but you know what we do see about her? Her character. Here's a point, I think it's important, and we'll get back to it a little bit later, and it's this, that it's your character that gives you your name. And we'll see that about her. You know, this girl here that in chapter 4 that we read that she's in his chamber, a young lady, not his wife, not his concubine, a young lady, you would think that she's in a no-win situation because this king is powerful. He can have her killed if she says no. If she says no way, he has that power. How do you get out of this? Well, you know what she has that Solomon doesn't? Character. And she does say no. She does say no way. And what you want is not going to happen. But boy, is she wise, because she says it in a diplomatic way. This is what she says in verse 5. I'm dark but lovely. And she tells us why. She says she's dark in verse 6, but we'll get to that. She says, I'm dark but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Don't look at me, she says in verse 6. It's like, don't stare. Because I am dark, because the sun has tanned me. My mother's sons were angry with me, and they made me the keeper of the vineyards. But my own vineyard I have not kept. She's acquainted with hard work. She's not Solomon's type. Her hands aren't soft. They're probably cracked and calloused because she's out working in the hot sun, tending to vineyards. Not really going to be Solomon's type, is it? You would think that he wants to see a woman with soft hands, not someone that is being beaten by the sun day after day, coming home tired, so here where she says, but my own vineyards I have not kept. She's talking about herself. She doesn't have time to pamper herself. Her nails are probably not long. They're probably very short because she works with her hands. Personally, I don't think Solomon ever had his hands on a shovel. I think she knew all about how to work a shovel and how to prune and how to harvest and how to work. But there's something else that she says out loud to him. She's not embarrassed. She's not fearful. Because she's a faithful young lady with character. And she says in verse 7, tell me, O you whom I love, where you feed your flock, where you make it rest at noon. For why should I be as one who veils herself? Actually, in the margin, it says wanders by the flocks of your companions. She's saying to the one she loves, where are you? Where are you, my true love? I don't want to be found wandering around where your companions are with their flocks. I want to be where you are, not here. Solomon doesn't care, number one, that he's married to others, and number two, that she's in love with someone else. Notice verse 12 of chapter 1. While the king is at his table, you know what that is? That's the wining and dining part. It's manipulation 101. You give a little in order to get what you want. That's in the male operating handbook that Solomon wrote. Feign a little interest, eat some food, drink some wine, have a little conversation. That's intimidating. He's a powerful, powerful man. And just notice how a queen was so bowed over. Is it bowled over? Bowed over? Bowled over? Bowled over? I think you know what I'm trying to say. Notice how the Queen of Sheba reacted by being with King Solomon. I'm not saying that anything happened between them. It's just notice the reaction by the queen. In 1 Kings 10, beginning in verse 4, you read, and when the queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he built, the food on his table, the seating of his servants, the service of his waiters, and their apparel, his cupbearers, his entryway by which he went up to the house of the Lord, there was no more spirit in her. What chance does this Shulamite have? Because she's in the same position, being wined and dined by the king. Solomon knows what he's doing. How many women did he do this to? It's easy to be pressured to compromise your morals. Many women before her were, I'm sure. Does she compromise? Does she give in? She's not attracted to or won over by Solomon. She's drawn to the one whom she pledged herself to marry, her fiance, that shepherd. This is what she says in verse 12. Again, while the king is at his table, my perfume sends forth its fragrance. A bundle of myrrh is my beloved to me that lies all night between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blooms in the vineyards of En-Gedi. She's faithful. She's not intimidated. The answer is no. Because all of me, she's saying, is waiting for him. My true love. A young shepherd. She continues in verse 16 by saying, behold, you are handsome, my beloved. She's saying this out loud. And Solomon's recording it. She's not saying it to him. She might be there in body, but her mind and her heart is somewhere else. He could see that. Behold, you are handsome, my beloved, yes, pleasant. Our bed is green. Other translations say couch. The beams of our house are cedar. Our rafters are fir. You know what she's expressing here? The desire to build a home with her love. Solomon had a house. Took 13 years to build. And actually, it was a huge, enormous house, a compound of buildings. There's a difference between having a home and having a house. Now, why did she choose these two trees? There are so many others in this region to pick from. You have the oak, the olive, the acacia, the plum. This is what I found researching the first one that she mentions, the cedar. The cedar is from a Hebrew word that means to be firm. The cedar represented incorruptibility. Because of the soft, spongy nature of the wood, the Romans used the tree resin to preserve books. The size and longevity of the tree symbolizes strength. That's the character of the tree. And she's saying, these are going to be the walls of our home, the structure of our life, incorruptible, with strength and firm. She's faithful. In verse 17 here, in the New King James, which I'm reading out of, it says, and our rafters of fir. Some translations say pine. A few other translations, as the King James, says fir. And yet there are other translations that say cypress. So I really didn't know where to go with that. But I looked up in Strong's. It's Strong's word 1266, which is a reference to the cypress tree. So that's why I wanted to focus on the cypress tree, because it's Strong's word 1266. And these are some of the facts about the cypress. The cypress is a large coniferous evergreen tree, and the wood is very durable, hard, and fragrant, and very resistant to decomposition and rot. It's one of the tallest trees in Palestine. And in Jewish tradition, the cypress was held to be the wood used to build Noah's Ark and the temple. And they say that the tree's shape is an example of uprightness, its evergreen nature, an example of eternal beauty and health. Also, the cypress is a long-living tree able to endure a harsh climate and poor soil. You know, when I read that, what came to mind? That this particular tree is able to endure a harsh climate and poor soil, to have and to hold. From this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness or in health, till death do us part. That's the character of it. That's the roof of our home, she's saying, that we're going to build together. The structure of our life. Being upright, being incorruptible, being firm, being strong, building a life by these principles that are godly principles. Character. I said earlier that it's your character that gives you your name. Please turn to Revelation 19. In verse 7, we read, let us be glad and rejoice and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come and his wife has made herself ready. Brethren, what's her name? If you're faithful, your name goes here. If I'm faithful, my name goes here. I looked up the word faithful in the Webster-Merriam dictionary, which really rounded out for me the significance of the word faithful. Faithful means to be steadfast. To be steadfast means that you are steadfast in affection or allegiance. It implies a steady, unwavering course of love, allegiance, and conviction. Faithful means that you're loyal. Being loyal implies a firm resistance to any temptation to desert or betray. Being faithful implies an unswerving adherence to a person or thing. Solomon was none of these things. The Shulamite was all of these things. Verse 7 again. Let us be glad and rejoice and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come and his wife has made herself ready. Well, how? By being faithful, by being steadfast, by being loyal, uncompromising, and strong in the ways of God. Displayed in how we live. Displayed in how we think. And displayed in what we do. And to her, it was granted to be arrayed in fine linen, clean and bright. For the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. Character. How did we get here? By looking at one of the smaller trees in God's garden. Taking into consideration the fruit of one branch. There's seven more to go. Don't let the size of the tree fool you. Every tree in the garden of God is loaded with fruit. And with fruit, we're supposed to take it and eat it, because it does something to you and me. I think certainly what we've seen with the first chapter that we looked at briefly is that Solomon was unfaithful. He was an unfaithful man at that stage of his life when he wrote that song. And he didn't even see that the object of his song was a faithful young lady. He didn't learn from it. He continued on in unfaithfulness and he ended up derailing his life. Whose marriage worked? Did the Shulamite's marriage work? Oh, you bet it did. Was she happy and fulfilled? Oh, I think yes. Solomon was married to 700 different women. But because of his unfaithfulness, I would bet not one was happy, and neither was he. Because he kept looking. He kept searching for that one. And he never had her because the problem was with him and his unfaithfulness. Seven more chapters to go. Take the time to go through this book or this tree, because it has so much to offer and so much to give. And it is a tree that is called the Song of Solomon.